From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. So are you a Mac or a PC person? Well, if you have an iPod, iPhone, iPad, or even an iMac, you might love it, or maybe you hate it, but you probably don't know much about the man who designed it. And we're not talking about Steve Jobs.
Behind the scenes, Jobs has a partner, and many people credit Jonathan Ive with changing the way people think about design. As part of our Creative Partnership series, NPR's Laura Seidel reports on the collaboration between Ive and Jobs.
At Apple, people often refer to the two men as Jives because they're so close. They often talk quietly over lunch in the company dining room or stroll around the grounds of the Cupertino headquarters. When Steve Jobs stood on stage in front of hundreds of people and announced the video phone feature on the iPhone 4, he made one call to
one of my best friends in the whole world, Johnny Ive, the head of our design team. Hey, Johnny, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Jonathan Ive and Steve Jobs have been inseparable since they met in the mid-1990s.
Steve's relationship with Johnny Ive is very symbiotic. Steve needs Johnny Ive, and Johnny Ive needs Steve.
Leander Caney is the author of Inside Steve's Brain. Ive came to Apple in 1992. At the time, Jobs was exiled from the company he founded. Apple had become bogged down with bureaucracy. Ive felt stifled.
He got buried in this big company. He was working on all sorts of very creative projects, very few of which saw the light of day.
In 1996, when Steve Jobs returned to save a company on the brink of bankruptcy, he began an evaluation of everyone.
He found Johnny Ive in a basement, surrounded by hundreds and hundreds of prototypes of all these prototype projects, and recognized immediately they had a talent there, you know, that should be put to work.
Jobs put him to work revamping the Mac computer. The two men seem to agree on a basic philosophy about design and products. Make the designs and the software simple and easy to use. Apple almost never lets media talk to anyone inside the company and would not agree to be part of this story. Ive gave a rare interview about his thinking behind the design for the first iMac to British television's Channel 4.
A lot of people at that point in time were nervous around computers, around technology. So a clear goal was, you know, how we could make the product accessible and not intimidating.
The result was the Fruity iMac. It was introduced to the world with a series of hip commercials that touted five bright color options.
She comes in colors everywhere. She combs her hair. She's like the rain.
The iMac reflected the Jobs Ive philosophy. Plug it in, and it works. No separate monitor, no rat's nest of power cords, no external hard drives. At the time, it was the best-selling computer model in history. Since then, Ive has led Apple's design team to create some of the most popular products of our time, the iPod, the iPhone, and now the iPad, all with the trademark minimalism. Ive says when he thinks about design, he thinks about details that matter to users.
As in the designer's taking care, the development team's taking care. No, I think we are surrounded by multiple products that really testify to companies who don't really care.
Ive was raised in a middle-class neighborhood in London and attended design school at Newcastle Polytechnic. While in school, his friends couldn't help but notice that his flat was filled from top to bottom with models for a project to help people communicate with children who had hearing problems. Each model was a little different because Ive kept redesigning it to get it right. Robert Brenner, who has since left Apple, hired Ive in 1992. He says Ive is relentless.
And you really have to be very relentless to get good stuff out in the market, and I think that is an attribute of Jonathan. He was very, very focused on getting it just right.
Jobs is equally obsessed with details, says author Leander Caney. The night before the iPod was introduced to the press, Jobs discovered that the headphone jack didn't make a click when you plugged in the headphones.
So he ordered the engineers to dismantle them all and put in headphone jacks that made a nice, satisfying click when you plug the headphone in. So these guys stayed up all night and then had to repackage the iPods in the morning to give to the journalists and the press. And it's kind of nutty. I mean, you know, who does that kind of thing? Who's going to notice?
Clearly, Steve Jobs noticed. He took execution of Johnny Ive's designs seriously. Keith Sawyer, a professor of education at Washington University who has studied creative collaborations, says Jobs and Ive together are responsible for what is now called design thinking.
Apple was at the forefront of this new movement, this idea that design is not something that you add in at the end when you're trying to pick a color scheme or how curvy the corners are going to be. Design is something that you have to build in from the beginning.
Here's Ive in a documentary about design called Objectified. He's talking about the iPhone and its big glass front.
Everything defers to the display. A lot of what we seem to be doing in a product like that is actually getting design out of the way. And I think when forms develop with that sort of reason, and they're not just arbitrary shapes, it feels almost undesigned.
Both Ive and Jobs believe that the hardware must work together seamlessly with the software. The iPhone and the iPod are part of a system, says Professor Sawyer, that includes a music store, a video store, and a bookstore.
It's not the way it was curved or where you put the buttons. It was thinking about the entire user experience of the iTunes store, of how you get the intellectual property rights with the record companies, right? So all of that together was what made the iPod successful.
To get it all right, author Leander Caney says it took both of them.
They're creative partners in the fullest sense. You know, it's not that Steve just sort of rejects stuff or accepts stuff. He gives very detailed feedback about the designs that Johnny creates. You know, they work together. It's a creative collaboration.
And it's hard not to notice that it's a collaboration that has resulted in products so successful that other companies, from Samsung to HTC, have tried to emulate them. But none creates the kind of excitement of a Jobs Ive design. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Up next in our series about creative partnerships, trapeze artists, a flyer and a catcher who trust each other with their lives.
My job is to save him all the time.
And just know he will catch me, that's it. This is for sure.
Cirque du Soleil's Andrei Chapin and Sergei Filipenko work together 40 feet above the audience, 8 shows a week. Their partnership is next in our series.
This is NPR News.
When Republicans won back a majority in the House this fall, they also won the right to set new rules for the floor of the lower chamber. The regulations address transparency, parliamentary procedure, and gadgetry. For the first time, electronics from iPads to laptops will be permitted on the House floor. That is, as long as they don't impede decorum. What that means exactly remains to be seen, but it's not the first time Congress will change its ways to accommodate a change in the times. To put this in perspective, we're joined in the studio by House historian Matthew Wasniewski. Welcome.
Thank you.
It seems to me we've already had sightings of members of Congress, you know, sneaking peeks at their devices in the chamber. What have the rules been and how have they been followed till now?
Well, in 1995, a rule went into effect banning all electronic devices on the floor. But in 2003, that rule was modified to specifically say no wireless telephones or personal computers. And the technology has kind of caught up to us. And so this rule will allow members to bring other electronic devices in, computers, as long as they don't impede decorum, as you mentioned.
And who decides that?
Well, that's up to the discretion of the speaker, what will impede decorum. It's kind of a fine line to walk.
Well, the House has walked this line before, going back a bit in time. Tobacco was an issue, something else that people have found addictive, like their Blackberries. Tell us how the chamber's dealt with tobacco.
When it comes to smoking and tobacco, Congress was way ahead of the curve. The House banned smoking in the chamber and in the galleries while the House was in session in 1871.
What made it an issue then?
Well, at that time, the House chamber, which is the modern chamber, we didn't have air conditioning. We didn't have ventilation like we do now. And smoke was a real issue for members. There were a number of members who complained about smoke and the ill effects on their health. But it was limited to just the chamber. Members could smoke in the Speaker's lobby. They could smoke in other places in the Capitol. In 2007, Speaker Nancy Pelosi banned smoking on the House side of the Capitol.
In the early 20th century, the House had to adapt to another trend, women in Congress. And I take it some thought that women's clothing would impede decorum.
Well, it wasn't so much that the House expected that. Some of the women members, the early women members, policed themselves. The very first generation of women, including a very influential one named Mary Norton from New Jersey, she believed women, if they were going to integrate and attain positions of power within the institution, they couldn't make themselves stand out. And so some of the things that she would do, she would insist on being called a congressman, and a lot of the early women did this. She would not get on an elevator if a male representative allowed her to go ahead. She would decline. And she also would sit on the floor, and she would watch women come onto the floor. And if they were wearing dresses she believed were too frilly, or if they tried to wear a hat on the floor, she would go up and say something to them.
As historian then of the House, let me ask you what perhaps has been the worst breach of decorum in the chamber.
Members in February of 1858 were debating a bill called the Lecompton Constitution, which was a pro-slavery constitution for the Kansas Territory. And the fight broke out along sectional lines. And we had 50 members in the well of the House brawling. We had members standing on desks cheering the fighters on. We had a member come down the aisle with a ceramic spittoon ready to whack someone over the head. The speaker is furiously gaveling the place to order, but no one's listening. The only thing that stopped it was when a member from Wisconsin named John Bowie Knife Potter was sitting atop Charles Barksdale from Mississippi, and he went to grab his hair, and he ripped off a hairpiece. And he stands up to the entire chamber and says, "Look, I've scalped him!" And the whole place breaks up in laughter. But it really spoke to these sectional tensions that were going on. I mean, afterwards, members are toasting themselves in the chamber and everyone's laughing it off. Alexander Stevens from Georgia, who would soon become the Confederate vice president, wrote home and said, "I don't know how much longer the Union can last under these circumstances."
Well, I guess it makes things today look just downright civil.
It does.
Matthew Wasniewski is the historian for the House of Representatives and joined us in our studios. Thank you.
Thank you, and Happy New Year.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. If you're resolved to stay on top of tech trends, we've got just the man for you. Mark Janot is editor-in-chief of Popular Science magazine. Last week, he looked back on the innovations of 2010. Today, we're looking ahead. Mark Janot, welcome again.
It's great to be here, Jennifer.
So 2010 seemed to be a great year for touchscreen technology. I'm thinking of the iPhone and other mobile devices. But I take it you see a shift coming.
Yes, we're going to be shifting away from touch screens in favor of touch-free screens. Basically, in the last couple of years, we've seen a trend towards touching our screens in order to do whatever we want on them. But now, in the wake of the success of the Wii, the Kinect, and the Sony Move, we're going to be controlling all of our screens and all of our media going forward using gestures. You'll be standing in front of your television and you'll be, waving your hands. It's basically like playing charades with your electronics, I think. So it's another form of entertainment, I guess.
Oh, no. So, but that means my kids can't play in front of the TV then. So that would throw things off.
I think that there will be very carefully defined gestures. But yes, I'm looking forward to the crazy chaos that's caused by unintended gestures causing, volume raising, channel shifting, that kind of thing.
Now, 2010 also saw a growing new market for 3D televisions. What's happening
yes,
there?
That was a big trend. I don't know if you share my feeling about this, but I myself have always been fairly dubious about the staying power of 3D as long as we need to put on those glasses, which are both costly and kind of ungainly. So the great trend that we're seeing emerge is glasses-free 3D, Naked Eye 3D, and it's already sort of about to emerge on the Nintendo 3DS handheld game, and that's the way it's going to emerge in this year on small screens and smartphones and things like that. But within the next couple of years, we should see actual TV screens where you can watch your shows and your sports in glorious 3D without having to look like a geek.
Turning to automobiles now, you say cars are going to get smarter in the name of safety.
Yes, we are going to, I guess, willingly cede some control over our cars so that we can keep ourselves and others safe. The sort of first example of this in the new year is from Volvo with their pedestrian detection system, which will actually notice if there is a pedestrian in the roadway up to 160 feet away. And if it senses that you aren't noticing, basically by, you know, seeing that you haven't slowed down, it will sound an alarm. And if you still don't do anything, it'll actually start braking without your efforts. And
wow.
If you're going at 22 miles per hour or slower, it will brake completely before it reaches the obstruction in the road. And if you're going a little faster, it'll at least get it down to a reasonably low speed. And there's another a new safety feature coming out from Ford called Curve Control. This is a system that senses when you're entering a curve, you know, like a highway off-ramp, too quickly, and it automatically reduces your speeds by up to 10 miles an hour in 1 second in order to keep you safe and keep you from rolling over potentially. 50,000 accidents a year are caused by people entering curves too quickly.
Hmm. Finally, I got to say, I am skeptical about this next item. You say 2011 will be the year of the flying car?
Or drivable airplane. It's maybe a small semantic distinction. But this is something that we at Popular Science have been touting for practically our entire 130-year
I can see it
history.
On the cover, yes.
Yes, many, many times. And I'm not going to let you down this time. This year will be the actual, no kidding, introduction of the Terrafugia Transition, which is a plane that can land on the tarmac, and then you fold up the wings and you drive it on regular roads to your home. So you're not just, you know, you're backing out of your garage and taking off on the street in front of your house. You do have to drive it to an airport, but it is a great transition, as it's called, towards our ultimate dream of the flying car.
All right, so I guess we now know that old cartoon, The Jetsons, was set in 2011.
There you go. The future is upon us.
Mark Janot, editor-in-chief of Popular Science magazine. He joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jennifer.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. Guy Raz is away. I'm Jackie Leiden. 2010, all a matter of historical record now. The grief, the gizmos, the raging partisanship, the dreams. Some of them came true and some didn't.
What is in store for 2010?
Anti-immigration movement.
Low inflation.
Green jobs.
The iPad.
Justice John Paul Stevens will retire.
Locally grown produce.
The reinvention of television.
Putting widgets on it for the internet, but not having 3D.
Twitter. Facebook.
$2.80 a gallon.
More homegrown terror threats.
Healthcare reform.
E-readers.
The Senate Democrats are going to lose their supermajority.
Jobs, jobs, jobs.
Predictions from early in 2010. Our cover story today, what lies ahead in 2011 in politics, technology, and at the fuel pump. Would you believe gas at $5 a gallon? That's what John Hofmeister, a former president of Shell Oil, foresees for the end of next year. He's the founder and chief executive of a nonprofit called Citizens for Affordable Energy. He says the reason prices will soar is simple. Demand is back.
American demand has returned to the 2007-2008 levels. Asian demand has increased beyond the 2007-2008 levels.
The jump from $3 to $5, how and why does that happen?
There's a psychology of oil pricing based on fear. Fear of shortage, fear of lack of supply. You have all the countries in the world that are importing oil making long-term contracts in the trading marketplace. And when the president and the interior secretary said in December that we were not going to pursue more offshore drilling, that sent a shock to the world trading marketplace that the U.S., once again, is not going to contribute to the crude oil supply of the world at a time when the world needs more crude oil. That's pushing prices up.
You're a former oil company executive. As you well know, this has been a political issue. Drill, baby, drill. Many, many experts posit that we couldn't possibly drill enough offshore oil to really offset this.
And I'm not proposing that we drill 20 million barrels a day. I'm proposing that we produce 10 million barrels a day, 3 million more than today, equal to what we used to produce 35 years ago. The oil is there. There's plenty of it if we would give ourselves permission as a people to go make it happen.
I feel a bit like Scrooge. Is this the scenario that will be, or is this a scenario that could be? Is there any better case scenario?
Well, I think there are some people convinced that we're past oil, that we should leave it in the ground, move on to alternatives. That's fine to say. But in the practical reality of everyday life, in a country that has no mass transit system that enables people to travel without personal transportation in any measure, then...
You're talking about us.
I'm talking about the United States of America, yes. Then we really have no choice with the 250 million cars on the road today but to put gasoline or diesel into those cars, depending on the engine. And we can talk about new ideas, talk about alternatives, but we live in today's reality, not tomorrow's future.
That's John Hofmeister, former president of Shell Oil Company. He also wrote a book, Why We Hate the Oil Companies, Straight Talk from an Energy Insider. John Hofmeister, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Jackie.
Now, if gas actually goes sky high, it could have a profound impact on the political world. Almost as profound, in fact, as the impact the Tea Party had this past year. Reed Wilson writes about politics for the Hotline at the National Journal. He's fascinated by what role the newly elected Tea Partiers might take in the Republican Party.
Well, I think we're going to see an immediate role with the Tea Party movement and sort of a highlighting of the schisms between the establishment Republican side and this sort of new populist movement. One of the very first actions that the new Congress is going to have to take is debating a new budget for the rest of the year. Then, about a month later, we're going to see a debate over the raising the debt ceiling. This is something that it's really not an option. People have to vote yes. If they don't, the government defaults on loans and the economy goes back in the tank. However, with these Tea Party members now in Congress, they came to Washington to cut spending. One of the first things their leadership is going to ask them to do is to vote to allow the government to spend more money. That's not going to be something that's very popular. So I think you're going to see a lot of these Tea Party members really sort of understanding the ways of Washington very quickly, getting their feet in the fire and having to realize, yeah, we have to vote to raise the debt ceiling, even though we've promised to cut spending.
So the political landscape becomes more complex. And speaking of that, it is astonishing to think 2011, it is really the primary staging year for the election of 2012, the presidential election.
That's right.
So again on the Republican side.
Again on the Republican side.
Who do you see as the pro-business, pro-populist candidate? Are the obvious names Mitt Romney, Sarah Palin?
Well, Mitt Romney really fits in on the sort of more managerial, more business, more establishment side. You've got a number of other governors who are considering running who would also fit that mold. Haley Barbour from Mississippi, Mitch Daniels from Indiana, possibly even Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, although he sort of straddles the managerial and more populist side. And then, of course, Sarah Palin, Mike Huckabee, even Newt Gingrich, big names on the populist side who are going to be able to tap into that Tea Party excitement that was so prevalent in 2010.
We know there's going to be a lot of tumult politically amongst the Republicans. Only one candidate can emerge as the winner of the primary. What about the Democrats? Might there be any other serious candidate for president in 2012?
I really don't think so. I mean, the notion that anybody would challenge a sitting president is pretty much gone. Nobody has seriously challenged a sitting president since Ted Kennedy challenged Jimmy Carter in 1980. But President Obama has to reach out. I mean, he's got to rebuild an electoral coalition. And his coalition in 2008 was an amalgamation of both liberal Democrats and centrists, even liberal Republicans. He put together coalitions that were able to win states like Indiana, North Carolina, Virginia, states that Democrats don't traditionally win. That requires this sort of broad base of support. President Obama is now going to have to rejigger his entire strategy because he is alienated. alienated a number of those portions of the electorate.
Anybody you're going to be looking at to see, you know, who functions best? That's part of the fun of this. Any political stars maybe amongst the new Republican governors?
Well, the new Republican governors, there are plenty. And really, Republican governors are the people who have in the past been able to sort of bring a new policy frontier for the Republican Party. That's what they did in 1994 with names like John Engler from Michigan, Tommy Thompson from Wisconsin. There were a number of new governors who really sort of reinvigorated the party. This year, you got to take a look at somebody like Scott Walker from Wisconsin, Tom Corbett, the new governor-elect of Pennsylvania, Nikki Haley in South Carolina. There are a number of those sort of rising stars who are really going to bring everything to the forefront and try some new things in a different way. And the states can be incubators for ideas at the federal level. Let's not forget that welfare reform came out of a program that Tommy Thompson tried in Wisconsin. So some of the things that these new governors are going to try now, we may be talking about them in a couple of years on the national level.
Reed Wilson is the editor-in-chief of National Journal's Hotline. Thanks again.
Thank you.
In the tech world, 2010 was the year social media exploded. Facebook, for instance, topped a half a billion members. But tech writer Clive Thompson sees a reckoning ahead.
I think we're going to see a kind of a tipping point in 2011 because a lot of people are becoming uncomfortable with how much they're putting out there. And this is a year we're going to begin to see them scale back a little bit.
And you're basing that on what?
Well, it's two things. One is that it's what I see happening around me in a lot of people that use it. And also, it reminds me of what we did with the mobile phone. Think about how the mobile phone became mainstream. When it first came along, everyone got overexcited, used it way too much. They were answering the phone at the dinner table, in church, you know, a completely inappropriate place. And it took about 5 years for people to figure out, no, I don't have to answer the phone when it rings. And I think that same social consensus is going to start to be built with social networking starting this year.
I am fascinated by something you've written about, a program named Broadcaster.
Broadcaster, yes. This just got released. It's very interesting. It takes this idea of sort of geographically placed data, like Foursquare, a new step. What you do is you can record a little bit of audio to leave embedded in space so that, you know, when someone goes by there, they'll see a note in the front saying, hey, someone left a message here, and you can listen to it. And so people will do it for playful reasons. You know, they'll leave little messages hidden for each other. Some people use it to review restaurants, and then you go outside the restaurant. That was horrible. You know, that was wonderful. So you're beginning to see this emergence of, like, really playful, silly, some dumb ways to implant information in geography.
I hope it stays playful. I mean, it sounds fascinating. Here's something. Amazon has sold over 5 million Kindles since the release of its Kindle Free. What about ebooks in 2011?
I think this is going to be a very explosive year for ebooks because the price of the ebook readers has dropped dramatically. I mean, they've cut by more than half in the last couple of years. I think by the end of this year, you'll see them getting blown out in clearance for like $50. And that completely changes the dynamic of who's going to buy that device. When it becomes almost as disposable as a pocket calculator, you'll see the vast majority of people switching over to ebooks.
Clive, what's in the offing? What'll get developed?
Well, you know, in 2010, Microsoft released this cool little thing called the Kinect, which is a little device that sits on top of your Xbox, and it looks at your body, and so you can use just waving your arms and moving around to control video games. And that's obviously a lot of fun. People have done, you know, soccer games, dancing games. But a bunch of hackers immediately set about reverse engineering it so they could use it to control their computers, and they succeeded. So they can sit there in the middle of the room and, you know, wave their arms to call up their email, or if their hands are messy while they're cooking, they could control recipes, you know, by waving their hands in their body. And over the next couple of years, we'll see the emergence of what you could call gestural interfaces. So the ability to control everything from your audio player to your computer just by waving your hands around, almost like Harry Potter-like incantations.
Wow. When I walk in the house and say dust and it does it, I'll think that'll be just fantastic.
Exactly.
That's Clive Thompson, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, also Wired. Clive, thanks.
Good to be here.
A piece of French technology may put an end to headaches associated with parking. This new device can help drivers locate free spots by contacting them on their cell phones. The technology was developed to deal with a slightly harder problem. It was first developed to help send scientific equipment to the planet Venus. Eleanor Beardsley has our story.
The southern French city of Toulouse is a festive place any time of year. In January, a dusting of snow covers its red-tiled rooftops, and an outdoor market buzzes with shoppers and vendors selling everything from jewelry to mulled wine. But just a block from this pedestrian paradise, the city's drivers face the daily reality of Toulouse gridlock. Sandrine Boulot is trying to inch out of a tiny parking space to join a long line of cars, slowly making its way up one of the city's narrow medieval streets. Her 2-year-old sleeps in the back seat. A 35-euro ticket for parking in a delivery zone lies on the dashboard.
If I'm lucky, I find a place. If not, I just go around and around and around until I do. It is so difficult to park in Toulouse.
That's exactly what Deputy Mayor Alexandre Martial wants to put an end to with his new parking aid.
The system is very simple. You have just to have a look on your smartphone, and you know in real time if parking spot is free or no.
Martial says the invention will cut down on gridlock and help the city to manage its parking spaces more effectively. And it will help the environment. Studies show that 60% of urban pollution in France is due to idling cars, many searching for a place to park. That also translates into millions of wasted hours for the drivers, says Martial.
I can reduce the waste of time. I can reduce the spending gasoline, yes. It's very important, I think, for the planet.
An idea Martial came up with several years ago has now become an actual prototype called Liberta. It's being tested on the streets of Toulouse by a local startup company with the same name. Tony Marchand, Liberta's technical director, points to a section of road where tiny receptors have been implanted just under the pavement.
These receptors send the information to that little box over there, which then transmits it to a central server, which sends it out to your telephone in real time.
The receptors store and transmit many different bits of information using radio signals. Marchand points out one car that arrived at 8 a.m. that morning and another car that's been there for days. He says most cities only collect about a third of the money they should from their parking meters. Next month, Liberta will widen the test area in Toulouse by installing 70 more sensors and hooking them up with a pool of 80 users. If all goes well, there are plans to cover the entire city by the end of 2011. Marchand says that while several such parking schemes are being developed in the world, Liberta is the only one that doesn't need a satellite connection, so it doesn't have the same problems as GPS systems, which are often blocked by narrow streets or tall buildings. At the Toulouse headquarters of the French Space Research Agency, Antonio Guel says he's in charge of bringing space research down to Earth. He says Liberta took advantage of space technologies developed and patented in France over the last few years.
They were researched and patented to help stratospheric balloons carrying scientific instruments land on Venus and communicate with each other without using heavy-duty transmission equipment. And that's really the advantage of Liberta, that it works without a satellite.
Liberta may soon be helping cars find parking spots in Toulouse and other cities in Europe and Canada, but there's one thing drivers may not appreciate, says Guel. Liberta will also be able to tell the police when the time's expired on your parking meter. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Toulouse, France.
A note from the news this week. The New York Times reported on a high-tech system to manage long lines at the Disney World theme park. In a subterranean command center, video cameras and digital maps with traffic light colors show where wait times are longest. Too many people at Space Mountain? An impromptu parade can draw folks over to Splash Mountain instead. Or maybe Mickey will appear to entertain the long line of tired parents and cranky tots. When I first read about this, I thought, fantastic. We've been to Disneyland, at spring break, of course. The euphoria wore off as soon as we became trapped amid the snaking rope lines at Dumbo the Flying Elephant. Quick, what's in my purse? Oops, didn't think to bring toys. The snacks are gone, and now we've run out of water. It was, we timed it, an astounding 45-minute wait for 90 seconds of flying through the air. My husband and I launched our own commando operation, trying to distract our poor boys from the most popular attractions. Let's just say we spent an inordinate amount of time clambering around the line-free Goofy's Playhouse and Donald's boat.
So shorter lines, yes, please. But I find something else about Disney's crowd management a little disturbing. Park officials say they feel compelled to liven up the experience of waiting since people today expect to be constantly entertained. The era of smartphones and video games, they say, has made us more impatient. So Disney has added its own video game stations. 87 of them line the route to Space Mountain. Now, I was taught patience is a virtue. Actually, my mom tried to drive home that point since I've never had much of it. But even I can feel the shift. My 12-minute metro ride to work used to feel like a welcome timeout. These days, I catch myself irritated at this unproductive chunk of time. Why can't I order new pants through my BlackBerry from an underground tunnel? I wonder about this because my oldest son just got a handheld gaming device for Christmas. As I watch him bent over, tapping away, I have to ask, is this eroding his attention span, sapping what precious little patience he's inherited? Will he be wait in line challenged? Then again, it has occurred to me this little device could be a wonderful travel companion, something that keeps his sanity and mine at the airport, on a plane, in a long line for Dumbo the Flying Elephant. Though I guess if we go back to Disney, I won't have to remember the handheld. For better or worse, they'll have us covered. You're listening to NPR News.